The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Villamez, and I write about LGBT history for the Philadelphia Gay News, and I'm incredibly honored to introduce our guest tonight. Author Andre Aciman will be interviewed about Find Me, his new novel, by Gary Kramer, a writer and film critic whose work has appeared in Salon, the PGN, and other publications. Find Me is Aciman's fifth novel, and is the sequel to 2007's Call Me By Your Name, which sold over 800,000 copies and was made into an Academy Award-winning film. Elio and Oliver's love has inspired people worldwide. Many fans, including adolescents, widows, prisoners, and priests, have written to Aciman to say thank you for sharing their story. Rather than quote one of the myriad critics praising Aciman for his masterful ability to write about desire, or for the unrivaled way, except possibly by Proust, in which he infuses his character's emotions into the syntax of the sentences themselves, I figured I'd quote from the man of the hour himself. Desire is always cagey, always secretive. We'll tell everyone we know about the person we crave to hold naked in our arms, but the very last one to know this will be the person we crave. Elio and Oliver learn to speak to each other and Call Me By Your Name. At the heart of the sequel, is their journey to speak to themselves, to rediscover their own truths. Both men meet new people who challenge them, people who force them to reconcile with their past and venture headfirst into their future. In the book, we're also given a window into Elio's father, Samuel, as he charts a new life for himself, one he previously believed to be unattainable. All three men grapple with the love they've tried to replace. And all three men learn that true love is impossible to forge. As one of the characters in Find Me says, some lives wait their turn because they haven't been lived at all, while others die before they've lived out their time. And some are waiting to be relived because they haven't been lived enough. I know we're all eager to jump back into the lives of Elio, Oliver, and Samuel, so that's what we'll be doing tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Andre Aciman and Gary Kramer.
Good evening. I'm Gary Kramer, by the way. Andre, we, like Elio and Oliver, have come full circle. We first met when you were here to promote Call Me By Your Name back on February 27, 2007. I have the exact date because you wrote it in my book. We've talked a couple times since then, but now may be a good time for me to confess that I am still like a love-struck teenager. I am Elio to your Oliver. I hope that's not weird.
No, it's perfectly healthy.
Okay. What is the weirdest response you've gotten to your indelible characters?
There's been many.
I figured there might be.
Actually, they're not that weird. They're confessional. People confess things, so they're never sort of outlandishly weird. They try to confide in me, and people write to me all the time, and they'll say all kinds of things. The weirdest one of all, because I said to one of them that I loved Maria Callas. And he sent me a picture of Maria Callas tattooed on his arm.
Wow.
So that is, I think, as weird as it gets.
Okay. Well, what was your intent in creating these characters? I mean, they have these really interesting qualities. And in Find Me, we get to see more of them. And so it's not just that you created them for Call Me, but for Find Me, you had to develop them years later. So how did you go about doing that? Or what was your idea of, or imagination of these characters a decade or so later?
Actually, they're rather simple characters, if you think about it. They have one trait, which I think somebody told me that this was the trait they all shared. I didn't even know. Nobody's mean in my books. They're all nice people. They really are good, decent human beings. The father is a good man, clearly, after that speech. How could you not be a good man? Elio is a super sweet kid with sort of intellectually precocious and at the same time emotionally mature and generous of himself, willing to take his life and offer it to someone else. And Oliver, too, for all his self-arrogance or self-confidence, which he has, which I never quite understood.
Self-confidence is sexy.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I couldn't understand that because it's so foreign to me. But I thought that he was a very nice, generous human being, a good man. And I think the mother in my book, she hardly has a personality. But in the movie, she's a nice woman too. Everybody's mm-hmm. nice. Mm-hmm. And there's like, there are no... I didn't know this. Somebody had to tell me this. Because this is how much sort of how much I know myself. We can discuss this further. Okay. But basically, I didn't know this. And it turns out that the whole universe of my characters is one of basically serene. They're all serene. For all their melancholic temperaments and their melancholia, they're just serene human beings.
We're going to get into their insecurities, don't worry.
Okay, fine.
What do you recall about the film Call Me By Your Name and making that and that whole process? Because it's sort of, you know, every writer's dream to have their novel become a bestseller and then be made into a hit movie, and you even got to appear in the film. What was that experience like? It's got to be a rush.
You think it would be a rush.
Yes. I do.
Actually, it was fun. It was fun to be in the movie because they told me, I flew in from New York to Milan. I was going to go to the hotel and sleep because I was tired, okay? But basically, they said the director wants you on the set and he wants to know your measurements. I said, my measurements? You know, of course, I'm obscene. So right away, I went there.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I figured he wanted to dress me up as something. And I said, I don't want to be in the film because I can't learn any lines. I'll forget them. And I'll get flustered and whatever. He says, you don't have to know anything. You just come on the set. We'll get. And I said, who am I going to be? One of the cooks, whatever? He says, you're going to be one of the two gay guys. I said, fine, who's going to be my partner? He says, it's going to be the producer of the film. So basically, we're all like, we had a wonderful time doing it. But that was it. So I was there for 2.5 days. And then I went away and never came back to the set. And as far as the rush is concerned, mm-hmm. it's something that I intellectually understand, but I don't take it with me. It doesn't inhabit me. I have to be reminded of it, as you've just done. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it just doesn't faze me at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I mean, you didn't want to adapt the novel for the screenplay,
right?
And I mean, you're very sort of
I remember
about
when
it.
I told you that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and it was sort of like, really?
No, I didn't want to adapt it. I figured, let them do it. Uh-huh. They know what they're doing. I wouldn't know.
James Ivory did a pretty good job.
I think he did. Yeah.
And
yes.
and rereading the book and seeing the film, I mean, whole dialogue, I mean, it's all your words.
Many of them are. Yes, it's true.
So, who's your celebrity crush?
Oh, you really want to know?
Well, we started talking about the movie, and I started thinking about Armie Hammer, so, you know.
No. It is probably Rachel Weisz.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
Because she's mean. Oh, she looks mean. And I love that.
She could be Clara in 8 White Nights.
Very much
oh,
so.
Oh, my God, yes. Okay, so all of your books have this narrative of return, and that's sort of what I like about them. You have a lot of observations about memory and nostalgia and how they shape our experiences. Mm. So can we get heavy and have you talk about that a little bit? Because...
Sure.
That's sort of what draws me. I mean, you know, Samuel returns back to the apartment in Find Me that he was at. You know, Elio and Oliver are returning to Italy in their minds and the relationship they had. But all of your books have this, Harvard Square,
right?
Enigma Variations, etc.
Because I think that we are I mean, we are the receptacle of all our memories. And some people know how to move forward, and I envy them, because basically, you say, I'm in the present time. I live my life today, not yesterday or tomorrow. In other words, they are the here and now. This is something I don't understand. It takes a lot of courage to live in the present and to basically turn a new leaf every day. New day, new blah, 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 blah. You know, that's not me at all. Me, it's more like I'm going to turn back now and go back and revisit the place where I used to live. I'll go back. In fact, as for the future, if I'm having a terrific time today, I'm already anticipating that tomorrow or next week, I want to make sure that I remember today as if it were something in the past while I'm enjoying it in the present time. Do you understand? This is how twisted I am.
I hope you're enjoying this now.
Yeah, I am enjoying it, but I tell you one thing. I'm already planning to do that next week. But that's how I do it. So my characters have a sense of longevity. They're not just in the present. They don't know how to live in the present. They're very much returned to the past as if there's something that was left behind. And they're already anticipating the future, so they're going there. And one of the things that happens in the father-son, father-daughter relationships, which I have in Find Me, which I think is a new leaf for me, is that every parent wants their child to take over their life and live it out more. In other words, I'm going to die, but I want you to finish my life because I have no closure in my life. And you might not have any closure, but we want to pass on our lives. The real truth is that every parent, and I see a lot of you are parents, every parent wants to inhabit their child's life, to basically not, they want their child to be like them so that they can inhabit that life and move on even after they die. And I think that this is again, it's an act of total generosity. It's not that I'm trying to dominate you and take you over. It's that I want to inhabit you and give you myself so that you can take me and go move forward.
I like that, yeah. I wish my mother was here to hear it. The characters,
that was mean.
The characters in your book wrestle with internal thoughts and insecurities. Does he or she feel the same way I do? Will I say or do something that might fuck things up between us, which I'm actually thinking right now? Can you talk about creating that palpable tension and anxiety? Because that's sort of the engine of your books, that yes. We get caught up in Elio's crush on Oliver. We get caught up in, you know, the hero of Eight White Knights and Clara. I want to know how you do that, because it's magic.
It's basically an attempt to project myself in. First of all, I project myself into the character. A lot of the characters who are insecure are me, of course. But
and your readers.
And no, but I want my readers to become like me. So I do all kinds of tricks to let that happen. I want to shock you with some of my boldness, but I'm not going to sort of totally unharness you with my boldness. I want you to say, gee, you know, he's bold, but then that's exactly what I feel. And so I want you to always share, however far I go. Now, clearly, none of you have played with a peach the way my characters, you're laughing, thank you. But basically, and I haven't either, okay?
I'm glad you clarified that. Okay?
But the question is, you do this, and you do it in such a way that people say, I understand. In fact, I will never do such a thing, but I totally, totally understand the pleasure and the zest of it, okay? So, and it all has to happen, and I'm just going to take another half minute to explain it. It has to happen because of the prose. The prose is written in such a way, the sentences are long so that you can easily slip into the clause one, and by the time you're in clause three, you're already entrapped. You have become me. You have shared my feelings, however obscene or absurd or outlandish they might be. You're there with me, and now you've bought into me. So I will confess everything that is most shocking about me, provided I make sure that you recognize yourself in there. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the guts to tell you things.
Yeah, it's a seduction. I mean, that's what your writing is, and I'm totally seduced by it. You're a master at describing desire and wanting and obsession, and we've talked about this in the past, but I think writing and exploring this universal emotion is seductive, is what makes your books sing and so great, because we get caught up in the characters wanting. I mean, Elio and Oliver in Find Me can't stop thinking about each other, even though they're in other relationships, even though they're miles apart and they haven't seen each other in years, and yet we want them to get together. Like, it's you're prolonging our anticipation.
I am, in a way, but one of the sentences that I like the most in the book, in Find Me, is a sense that I know he is thinking of me precisely because he hasn't written, because he hasn't called, because he hasn't shown a single sign. I just know, just as I know that he knows I'm thinking of him all the time, precisely because I'm not writing. And if you all think of the first love of your life, and we think of the first love of our life many more times than we care to admit, we will understand that they too are thinking of us. And it's a written law that I have decided is written, okay? That we think of things all the time that we are ashamed to admit that we think of.
Okay. That's a good segue for my next question.
Oh, God, what did I get myself into?
Your books always have someone stomping into your life and altering its rhythm. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see if you could describe someone who impacted you that way.
You mean personally?
Yeah, because, you know, you're a teacher, and your books often have teachers or professors in them. Wow. And teachers often change your life. I can think of several in my life.
Yep.
Who has impacted you in a great way, like a teacher or someone, a stranger, who becomes like your best friend or your wife or whoever?
I don't know. I can't think that way. I have had teachers who have had great impact, who have taught me things that I still believe in and still use in my writing and in my classes as well. In other words, a high school teacher could teach you things that will last a lifetime. This is how generous people can be. But I lots of people have impacted me. Some have impacted me for the better. And some for the worst.
Right, sure.
And those who have impacted me for the worst, you know, I resent, but I can't get over it.
Resentment has virtue, I believe.
Yes,
this.
Yes, and vindictiveness also does, by the way. And vengeance has to be served hot. This thing about cold vengeance.
No.
Worthless.
Get it while you're angry. Yeah.
I like to do it in the here and now. If that's the only time I'm in the here and now, when I'm nasty.
Well, what kind of person are you when someone gets to know you? Because that's something that's from one of your books, and I kind of like that idea. It's like you have these characters who put up these false fronts, or they project who we want to be, not who we are.
Yes.
And this shifting nature of identity, this idea of belonging, this living a double life. So what kind of person are you when someone gets to know you? Because I feel like I don't know you, and I've known you for 12 years.
Well, you should ask the people who live with me. Actually, I have a theory, which is that we're not truly ourselves with the people with whom we are most intimate with. We're more ourselves with strangers. Mm-hmm. This is a total contradiction, but it's a damnable contradiction.
Well, it's like Samuel on the train.
Yes, you meet somebody on the train, you open up. There's no danger, you'll never see that person again. Just say what comes to your heart. And if that person is beautiful, you might even pay them a compliment. Might even try to seduce them if you could, you know. Anything. You just open because there are no risks. Whereas in the people that you live with, like your parents, for example, or your children, you have many sort of walls and the things become more delicate. And because they are more delicate, you feel that there are more risks. And so you have to watch yourself. And when you watch yourself, you're no longer really yourself. Whereas with a perfect stranger, or with a colleague that you meet at work, or with a secretary, you can be as open as possible because there are no risks, there are no repercussions. You don't care. And it's precisely because you don't care that you can be open.
Well, on that same note, your characters share instant affinities, and I've always liked that. I love that quality of your work. Loving something because somebody else did. So, you know, you and I talked about playing tennis once because I read about it in Enigma Variations. Yeah. We haven't done it, and I'm terrible. And I'm terrible at it. But you said you wanted to do it, so I was like, "Yeah, let's go do it. Let's go play tennis." Yeah.
But I haven't played since I spoke to you. So
nor
that
have
was
I.
3 years ago. Okay.
Yes. But what is something that you've grown to love because someone else introduced you to it? What is something that you?
Oh, I would say Mahler's Second Symphony. Somebody introduced me to it, and I said, thank you for telling me this. And I resent being introduced to something, you know, because who am I? You know, who are you to tell me to like something? But I immediately loved it. And through this love, and actually that person happens to be my brother, and I was extremely grateful to have discovered Mahler's Second Symphony, which I didn't know at all. How many of you know it? Okay, there goes the hand. You know what I'm talking about, right? That, okay, so was it my brother? Or?
I'm like, might get the CD. Let's talk about music. I was going to save that question for the lightning round, but what do you listen to? Because your books are really heavy in music, and Find Me has a whole section where he's got this, you know, composition that he's got to solve.
But I can't listen to music while I write. There's absolutely no problem, because the music of the prose goes one way, and the music goes another way, and obviously I can't, I have no ability to sort of do the two at the same time, so I always turn off the music when I'm writing. I listen to music when I'm doing grunt work, like writing letters of recommendation.
But what kind of music do you listen to? That's what I want to know.
Oh, I listen to lots of things. I mean, right now I'm going through a Schubert Lieder phase, but I listen to mostly is chamber music. Okay. I love chamber music, and that's what I listen to. And it depends. There are all kinds of things. I'm at the gym. I'm always listening to music.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You often emphasize place in your books, and I'm curious why place, such as Italy, in particular, so important and so special to you?
I think I got to like Italy, but Italy is really a stand-in for me. It's not really Italy that I like. It is what Italy promises. In other words, beautiful beaches, beautiful weather, beautiful people, beautiful houses, beautiful all kinds of
great
things.
Great food.
Great food, and actually I said it's a stand-in because it's really, it's Egypt that I constantly, I cannot write about Egypt because I feel uncomfortable doing it, so I have transposed everything about that I loved about Egypt, that I grew up with in Egypt, and I have transposed it into Italy. So the family that you see in Call Me By Your Name is in fact an Egyptian family, Jewish family in Egypt, living comfortably and learned, liking the arts, liking guests all the time. People come into the house all the time, and the beach. And so, and the senses are always sort of in a state of arousal. I don't think you can do that in London.
But now I want to know, will you return to Italy to Egypt for one of your books? I mean,
no,
you can't do it?
No.
Because Out of Egypt is phenomenal. And
it's done,
I mean,
well.
I guess maybe that is the last word you'll have on it.
Yes, I don't think I want... My sons want to return to Egypt with me. They want to go to Egypt. They're not returning. They want me to show them Alexandria. But Alexandria has changed so much. Yeah. And the character of the city that I used to know, which was a medley of many ethnicities, many nationalities, and many languages, all has disappeared. So there's nothing for me there except masonry.
It breaks my heart. What place is on your bucket list to see? Where do you want to travel that you haven't been?
You see, the problem is that I don't like to travel.
You don't?
I mean, this is the truth. This is the absolute truth. I hate traveling. I like to stay in New York City, and I like my little study where I sit and write and imagine being elsewhere. I mean, that's the honest truth. I know myself. I know what I don't like traveling, although we do travel quite a bit because I get sent to places and my wife comes with me most of the time. We went to India for about 3 weeks and I didn't really enjoy it. But I feel embarrassed to say it because they treated me fabulously. The hotels were amazing. The food was terrific. We didn't eat street food, though I was dying to. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I mean... Traveling is not for me. Usually, the only travel I like to do is to go either to London, which I do like, and to Rome, which is the other place I like.
And that's interesting, because I would think you would travel. I mean, I know you've been on a 14-city tour in 14 days, so I can see why travel is probably not...
Not my favorite thing.
favorite thing right now. Let me ask you, great art doesn't change us. Instead, it reminds us of who we've always known we were and are destined to remain. This is a line you have in Find Me. Mm. I think Call Me was great art, and it did that. It changed us, but it reminded us of who we were. I hope Find Me does the same for readers. How did you come to that conclusion?
Because great art, the very best, I'm saying you stare at a painting by, I don't know, Monet, because I like Monet, or you stare at a painting by Velázquez, or by those wonderful paintings by Goya, which are the black and white paintings, I don't know if you know them, at the Prado. They're amazing. You look at these things, okay, here's a past example, The Head of a Dog by Goya. Just the head of a dog, which seems to be drowning because you don't know where it is. It basically brings out, as all great music does, as all great literature does, it brings out the very best in us and reminds us of who we are not. In other words, how much do we fail when we look at a great piece of art and we say, this is fantastic, and now let me look at myself. Who am I? What did I do? What do I bring to planet Earth that is going to make such a difference? And it basically, it's an invitation to do better, to become better. You look at the work of art, and it's sort of a spur to discover something that you know the work of art is telling you. You know you're familiar with it, but you've never really thought about it. So it tells you who you are and what you want in life. But you have to work for it. Mm-hmm. And it's an encouragement, and at the same time, it's very discouraging. So we go back to the same museum to see the work again, to see what it is. Because when you look at a great piece of art, especially painting, or even music, you are trying to listen and you're trying to stare because it's speaking to you. But at the same time, you're looking at it to understand why it is speaking to you. There are two different gestures that happen sort of coincidentally together. So you are always confused by great art, and yet at the same time it reminds you of how small you are vis-a-vis art. That's how I feel when I look at The Cypress by Van Gogh. I look at it and I know I'm looking at it and I'm trying to understand why I'm looking at it, and it makes me feel as if it's telling me what life is. It is telling me clearly what life is, but I need to understand it again and again because I keep forgetting. And chamber music does the same thing. It tells me about the very best in life, and then suddenly I forget and I have to listen again.
Wow. Let that sink in for a second.
Thank you.
Impressive. I feel that way when I see films. I feel that way when I read books, yeah. Yours in particular. I do feel that when I look at a Courbet painting. And it inspires me to work and to be better, as you say. But it also makes me appreciate it, that something like this exists.
Yes.
And that it can be created, and that I can imagine doing something like this, or finding something that's human. We were talking before we came out about a passage in your book, Eight White Nights, and how it just devastated me because the characters basically infected. Clara infects this young man, and he can't give her up. He can't be without her. He wants to be with her all the time. And I like that your books make us feel that way, that we want to be with these characters. I mean, you bring back Elio and Oliver, who are characters that were so indelible. Can you talk about the decision to do that? I mean,
it basically was a difficult decision because I had to age them. Mm-hmm. So they're no longer the same. Mm-hmm. Elio is now 32 years old, and Oliver is, wait a minute, he's not 32, he's 37, because Oliver is 44, mm-hmm. when they finally meet again. And obviously, they've changed. They've aged. They've had experiences. A whole lifetime has gone on without each other. And so there's no way that they will ever catch up. But there is something that goes on. And I love when I read, and I'll jump ahead somewhere else, when I read about two people who were high school sort of sweethearts, and they got married. Each got married to a different person. They both become widows. and they meet again 50 years later. And guess what? It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed. And I believe that. And I think that this is the most beautiful thing in life, is that however much our paths have diverged and basically can seem never to come back together again, there is always something that remains and is not just a whim. It's something profound about us that remains and that we want to reconnect. And guess what? We can reconnect. The fact that something happened in the past and cannot be rekindled is a lie. I don't believe it.
Mm. Yeah, that's the friction in your novel. It's that these characters really do desire each other, and you ache to get them together. And I love that you create that ache, because I feel that sense in all of your books. I'm going to switch things up a little bit. I love when your characters in your novels talk in gestured messages. They can communicate silently with expressions. We can't really do that here, but I'd like to ask some lightning round questions, or as you would describe it, verbal ping pong.
Okay.
Do you keep a diary like Elio in Call Me By Your Name or the protagonist in Harvard Square?
Yes.
And what's in your diary?
The filthiest thoughts. No, my diary is usually, it's never about what happened today. That's the dullest thing. So you will never find anything about my life in it. But you will have my whims, my wishes, my desires, my memories especially. God, I remembered this again today. Or the first time that you remember something after 40 years, suddenly you want to jot it down. It means something to you. Or you meet somebody who said something absolutely wonderful or horrible. And you want to say, why did they say that to me? And
you live in New York.
Yes, that's true. I should have known
that's the
better.
Answer. Did you always want to write, or did you have other aspirations?
I did many things in my life, many, many different professions. But I think since the age of 9, 10, I wanted to be a poet. I knew that. Mm-hmm. And my father sort of encouraged that. So it was known in the family that I was a poet. Did you know that? And of course, when I reread that poetry, and I don't have it anymore, but it was horrible. It was disgusting. But I was a poet, okay? My father said I was a poet, so I was a poet. Mm-hmm. But then eventually, at the age of 17 or 16, I decided poetry is not for me. I don't understand modern poetry. I'm writing ancient sort of traditional poetry, and I might as well sort of take a step down and move to prose.
What poets do you like?
Oh, I like the typical ones. Browning, Shakespeare, of course. I went through a Keats phase. Now he tires me, but I'm rediscovering him again. And I mean, there's all kinds of poets that I love, and particularly English poets. Those for me are the best. I went on a visit to Tintern Abbey. Because I think that Tintern Abbey is probably one of the greatest poets in the English language. It's not fantastic poetry, by the way, but it is among the most profound ones.
Okay. Your characters have rituals. They're vigils in Find Me. There's the Greek diner breakfasts and Eight White Nights. What are your rituals?
My rituals, there are superstitious rituals and there are rituals.
I'm very superstitious, go
yeah.
for it.
So my superstitious rituals, for example, I will always take the subway at the tail end, never at the head. Because when I do it at the head, bad things happen to me. So I do go to the tail end of the subway station. However, if I'm too confident that good things will happen to me because I went on the back, then I get punished and so I have to pay homage and go to the front. Do you see what a twisted person you're dealing with here? You didn't know, did you? But I have rituals where, I mean, there are things that I do. I mean, every morning I get up, I make coffee for my wife, I make coffee for myself. I go to the gym in the morning, then I come home and I work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you do the crossword puzzle at the
Tweet
Diner?
Never, never. I'm terrible at crossword puzzle. I hate crossword puzzles.
I almost brought it to you today to
Did you see what I hate that, and I hate Scrabble.
My God, we can't talk anymore.
That's fine.
I am obsessed with Scrabble. You blew my mind. The Egypt was great, and the other speech was really great, but that did it. You write about laughter being the key to relationships. Mm. What makes you laugh?
Anything. I love laughter, and I love somebody who can make me laugh. Make me laugh, and I'm your friend for life. I love laughter, and I like to make people laugh, too. So laughter is, for me, the key to someone else. If somebody and I laugh together, we're going to be in love, in some kind of affinity, for the rest of our lives. Because we know all we have to do is look at each other, and we burst out laughing.
No, I'm laughing. But are there specific comics or you know, do you watch certain funny movies?
The movies that are funny, sure. I mean, I'm a clown for Love, actually. I've seen it. I've seen it a million times because I fly all the time and it's always playing and there's nothing else to see. I don't want to see special effect movies. So, okay, I'll see Love Actually again. I know it by heart.
No Scrabble and Love Actually. We are. It's over.
That's it. It's over.
It's over. You know, you wrote all about Eric Romare in Eight White Nights. I was hoping you would sort of go in that direction.
No, Eric Romare is my favorite director. There's no question.
Uh-huh. What specifically about him? I mean, they're very talky films, very angstful characters.
I like the fact that the characters are constantly investigating and interpreting each other, mm-hmm. but they're doing it through language. They talk. And they have interesting conversations, the kind of conversations that I've had with people who I admire. You have an intelligent conversation, not about, the chit-chat that we normally have with people. These are smart conversations. They're not intellectual conversations, but they are conversations that have a certain kind of effect. They help one person reveal himself, herself to the other person while they're talking about, you know, something seemingly highfalutin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. And your books do that because you have so much more beneath the surface of the characters when they're talking about simple things. The train sequence in Find Me with Samuel and Miranda is fantastic because you're just caught up in the narrative. You get caught up in this dialogue, and before you know it, 100 pages have transpired, and you're like, "What's going to happen next?"
They're going to have sex,
and it creates the I don't want to spoil it. They haven't read it yet.
Oh, didn't you know? I mean,
there is talk about Find Me being turned into a film. Is that going to happen?
No, there is no talk.
No,
there is no talk. Literally, there is no talk. So we're waiting.
Okay. What do you like to read? I mean, you talked about poetry.
I do read. I read. I'm always reading things, but I'm never. Here's a key. I want to be enchanted by what I read. Mm-hmm. And to be enchanted for a person like me means it's got to be rigorously defined. It has to happen within certain sort of, it has to have certain things in place for me to be enchanted. It's not easy to enchant me. So I want something to be very well written. It doesn't just have to be written. It has to be very well written. It has to have a certain degree of depth that you recognize on the first sentence of the book. You recognize it. And you want things that are going to have impact in your life. Not just in, I don't want to be entertained, and I certainly hate when people tell me, I just want to see a movie. I want to see something stupid. I can't, I hate that sentence.
No,
you
want to
see something stupid, you're stupid, okay?
I'm right there with you.
You know, it's just, I hate that. So I need to be taken from who I am into a different sphere. Lift me off the ground. Okay, don't give me crappy prose, because most people write crappy prose, and I can't stand it.
Mm-hmm. Any particular books that you recommend?
That crappy prose? Plenty.
No.
Well, there's one that I've been recommending for the past 15 years, and it's becoming embarrassing, but it's by a German writer called Sebald. And it's called The Emigrants, or Austerlitz is also a very good book. Mm-hmm. He's a smart man. He writes extremely well, even in English, though it's translated. He's the person behind the translation anyway. This is a brilliant, brilliant writer, sort of of Nobel quality. Most Nobel Prize winners are really frivolous, but he would have gotten the Nobel Prize, and he would have deserved it. I mean, he's a magnificent writer.
Okay.
And I like that. And the issues that he addresses are not just about the Holocaust and Jews. It's deeper than that.
Okay.
You're looking at me as if yourself.
No. I'm thinking it's like, do I have time to read that?
I've got
a stack of books on my table. I can't get to them all.
Has anybody read Zibelt here? Oh, see, you have an interesting crowd here. Okay.
Yeah. We're in Philadelphia. We're clever. I think we have to open it up for questions. Yes? And how are we on time? Yeah. Okay. Before we open up to questions, let me ask you one more before we start. With Elio and Oliver, would you write another sequel?
You know, it's funny. I thought I wasn't going to. And I said, okay, that's it. I've done Find Me. But it is really amazing the degree of enthusiasm that people have. It is infectious. Mm-hmm. And there's a particular moment that I want to explore. And I don't know. I don't know that I will or will not, but because I'm doing many other projects. But it's sort of sitting in the back of my mind. It wasn't a month ago.
Good. We want a sequel. All right. I'm going to open up to questions. Anyone have questions for Andrea?
Can you tell us a little bit more about your writing process?
My writing process?
Yeah.
All right. Here it is. You mean the process, not when I write or how I write or the process. I usually rewrite a sentence many, 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 many times. That's a fact. It has to feel finite, and it also has to have the right rhythm and the right cadence. Everything has to be right. Otherwise, I'm not done with it. But more importantly, as I begin writing a sentence, as I'm writing it, I have a countervailing instinct which says, let's change where you were headed. And so right in the midstream of the sentence, I'm already considering a different sentence. And so now there's a process of negotiation going on. And that happens not only when I've written a few paragraphs, but also after a few pages. Right in the, as I reread the pages, I realize that there's something is missing in the middle of those three pages. So I go back in there and fill it with some more information, thus displacing the stuff that comes subsequently. And I'm constantly doing this. I'm in the middle of a sentence, I will rewrite the sentence. In the middle of a page, I would insert something in the middle or take away things and move it elsewhere. I don't build a wall and then the first floor and then the second floor and then the third floor. I'm constantly demolishing what I've built to rebuild it again. But it's, for me, it's an okay process. I mean, I don't dislike it. It's how I write. So I'm right from insecurity, not from certainty. Absolutely. I have no idea where I'm going. Most people like to have an outline. I never have an outline because it doesn't serve its purpose. I will change my mind. Plus, I don't want to know where I'm going.
Does that account for why you write in this elliptical style you've taken up with Enigma Variations and now Find Me, where you do sort of different chapters as opposed to a continuous full-stream novel?
Yes. I find that I enjoy more the fact that every chapter, call it a chapter if you will, but it may not be a chapter. Yeah, every section is its own whole. It ties into the rest, but it has its own life, whereas a novel has a life that spans all through the chapters, and you can tell the character is going from A to B to C to D. Here I felt that it might take too many pages. It would take 3,000 pages for me to write Enigma Variations, because it's the story of a man at the age of 12 till he's in his middle 50s. So I didn't want to do this Proustian thing of going through the whole litany of his life. I just chose chunks that were illustrative of what happened in his life at that moment. And I like that system because it forces me to essentially close something that would have been totally open-ended and beyond my control.
Thank you for coming, Andre. And something that has penetrated me very deeply is the relationship between Elio and Oliver. And you created it in the book. They have carried it into an actual relationship that I think you meant to express in the book.
Let's be very honest here, because when you're writing a novel like that, I was on contract for another novel, and I had to submit that manuscript soon, and I interrupted this other novel, Eight White Nights, because I was just too difficult, and so I started writing something that was going to give me pleasure, and it was good. Call Me By Your Name. And I finished it very fast. I wanted to get it done very fast. There was a moment in the middle of the book when it was clear that Elio and Oliver were going to be in love, that I had to stop writing this novel. Otherwise, you know, I had to go all the way. And yes, I discovered that basically I had a choice to stop, and something was going to happen to Oliver, and he was going to drown. And that would have basically, that's the end of the story. And then I decided, no, I'm going to take it to the next step, and the next step, and the next step. And I had them fall totally, totally in love with each other. That was not anticipated. And of course, their love blossomed beyond anything I knew. And I took it. I didn't want to let go. Even in the chapter in Rome, they're just walking together, half drunk in Rome, totally in love with each other, and totally happy. And I just had no idea that this is what I was doing.
So with this question is just a little bit of preface, I suppose. So with Call Me By Your Name and everything that it stands for me specifically, it gives me the ability to watch, I guess specifically the movie with someone, and afterward look them in the eyes, put my hand on their shoulder and tell them, this is what I've wanted my entire life, but I've never been able to say it. With this, how does it feel to have the ability to enact so much emotion in people? And do you believe that everyone has the ability to do this?
The answer is yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a sentence that I love, which I steal sentences from left and right. But there's a sentence that I love in Find Me, which says, to be in love takes courage. To fall in love and letting oneself fall in love is a very courageous deed. I didn't know that. But it requires courage. I think everybody not only has the capacity to fall in love, but they want to. They absolutely need to and want to. But it's also, falling in love is a risky thing. It's risky because you can get very hurt, and the hurt may never go away, by the way. It can stay for the rest of your life. Or it can spoil things for you, because things can get ruined very badly. But at the same time, I've never said, I'm not going to do this because I might get hurt. One has to do it. You have to throw yourself in. It's a wonderful moment when you do that and somebody else does it with you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're in heaven. You're in heaven. It's magical, because I think the most beautiful thing on planet Earth is intimacy with anything, with someone in particular. But you could be intimate with music too. But intimacy with someone, in other words, they are you and you are them, and you're bound together. Now, will it last? That's the other question that I can't answer. The one thing that I always tell people when they ask me about love and the passion that comes with love is that I always describe love until the moment when people decide to be together. The one thing I don't want to describe is their domestic life. Because you know what happens. You've heard me say this before. On Sundays, what do? You do the laundry and you fold the towels. And that is not romantic.
It can be.
So at one point, Ilya's looking at the moon and imagining a conversation with Bach. And Bach says, I'm an artist, my friend. I don't do answers. Artists only know questions. So as a writer and an artist, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that you give more answers and questions? And can you just talk about that?
Thank you. That's a wonderful question. I don't think, as a writer, I never thought and never presumed that I had anything to say to people that they didn't already know. I was not going to message anything. There was no theme to my work. There was no, so I wasn't going to teach you anything, because who am I to teach anyone anything? But I didn't know that I was giving sort of I was mapping out the possibility for many people to find love, to speak about their love, to come out to their friends and parents about their loves and whatever they wanted in life. I didn't know that I was making it, I was giving you a sort of template for this. That was not my project. I only know how to give stories. As far as answers are concerned, I would have no idea what answers to provide. And I think art is not in the business of providing answers. It is in the business of asking questions.
Right. We like ambiguity.
I like ambiguity, first of all, because I think we live in ambiguity. We always will. Even when we believe something forcibly, we're still ambivalent about everything. But I do think that art is a way of addressing fate or God or whatever you want to call it, and saying, why are things this way? Why are things this way? Why don't things work for me? That's what art does. It asks that question in many guises. It has no answers, but it asks the question.
How do you construct the storyline that what inspires you to write this sequel?
I wanted to be with the characters again. I've always wanted. For many years I wanted to, and I couldn't because I was not able to. I also wanted to inquire about the father. I was interested in the father. And I wanted to know, you know, these people have lives. They do live life, and not together. But at the same time, I wanted to understand how is it that one can live life, sometimes even fully, and still have a little margin left over from the past. And that is one thing. That was the subject of the book for me. It was that margin of the past that endures and will not go away. And remember what the father said in Call Me By Your Name. He said, don't crush it, don't stifle it. Let it happen on its own. You will eventually get over this. You can get over something, but it doesn't mean that you're not in love with it. But you're now not in a state of pain. And I think that this is what they're discovering gradually. And I wanted to tell you that story, which is more complicated than the story of the first romance. Mm-hmm. How they finally confess to each other that they love each other, how they have sex the first night together, how they have sex again and again and again. Okay? That is beautiful, and I like that. But when you have time interferes, or, as I like to say, time happens to us, and it changes things, and we have to adapt. And at the same time, we still have the will to maybe seek something that we haven't given up on.
Did you ever imagine you would have such a devoted following to Call Me By Your Name, also known as The Peaches? 23,000 people that belong to that group, and how obsessed they are with the book.
Did I imagine it? Of course not. No, I didn't even imagine that the book was going to be published. I didn't have that kind of confidence. I thought my agent is going to look at it. She's going to say, Andre, what the did you do here? What is this? I thought it was it came from me, and I was happy that it came from me. But I thought she was going to be offended and shocked, and she sold it 24 hours later. And I said, well, no, who's the person who's going to buy this book? And what's happened to him? What? But in fact, it was my editor, my already editor. So I said, I don't know what's going on here. So I had absolutely no idea. And when the reviews came out, they were glorious reviews. I had no idea that this was I didn't. And then there's a movie too. I have no idea. And The Peaches. Oh my God! This is beyond anything. It's an amazing thing. I went to India, and everybody had read "Call Me by Your Name." So I'm saying, okay, if in India they read it, where else? Everybody knows it everywhere else. So it's a wonderful feeling. And at the same time, I'm saying, maybe I fooled them. Maybe they're all mistaken. Maybe they're just being carried away by the. Oh, it's Timothy. They're all in love with Timothy anyway. You know. It's nothing to do with me because I'm so insecure and that I can't believe that something I put on the planet has generated so much, actually so much love. Mm. And on the other hand, don't think I'm not grateful. I'm extremely grateful. But I'm always waiting for the other shoe to fall, you notice? I'm that way. You probably figured it out. I'm Jewish, okay?
Yes. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.